This is the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore, and we welcome Dave Green to the program. How you doing, Dave?
Twice in 1 month, Bob, I'm doing excellent.
Yes, good to talk with you. We're going to continue, at least in part, on this edition of the podcast, our discussion of the history of boxing. You remember we had Paul Beston on last week talking about what he described as the boxing kings. He singled out seven heavyweight champions of the world: John L. Sullivan, Jack Johnson, Jack Dempsey, Joe Louis, Rocky Marciano, Muhammad Ali, and Mike Tyson. And no sooner had I posted this, Dave, on Facebook, than you know, you got the comment section.
Mm-hmm.
Reader of Facebook, and I hope listener of the podcast wrote, "What? No Gene Tunney? What a disgrace."
Oh, there's a famous name.
Well, it turns out that famous name is in one of my books. So I thought, well, we can answer our critic, and we're going to talk about a story I have in my most recent book, published by History Press, Lost Mohawk Valley, which is titled Champion Boxer Gene Tunney Trained in Speculator.
Oh.
Yeah. World heavyweight champion James Joseph Gene Tunney trained for his most important fights in Speculator in the Adirondacks in the 1920s. Speculator is a village in the town of Lake Pleasant in Hamilton County. Born in New York City in 1897, Tunney was one of seven children of a poor Irish immigrant family. Tunney said, "In the home of my rearing, prayer was regular and fervent." He joined the U.S. Marines in World War I and ended up fighting in the ring more than in the trenches, becoming the boxing champion of the U.S. Expeditionary Forces. Tunney met a man named William Osborne from Speculator in the Marines, and Osborne invited Tunney to come to Speculator and establish a training camp. Osborne, who was serving in the military, I will say to his credit, you know, he was a rich man. He owned two hotels and tourist cabins in the Adirondack Village. So in 1926, Gene Tunney trained in Speculator for his first World Heavyweight Championship fight, and it was against Jack Dempsey.
And every Hollywood film I have ever seen, Bob, has that exact scenario going. Whenever the boxer is training, in other films, James Cagney would star.
Yes.
They were always somewhere in the woods.
That's true. Well, in this case, the woods was Speculator. And Osborne thought this could be a great thing. And in fact, it became true. He thought that if Tunney came, other fighters would follow, and they did, at least for a period of time. Tunney defeated Jack Dempsey in a 10-round decision. Osborne publicized Tunney's training camp, and tourists started coming to boost Speculator's economy. Tunney trained in Speculator for his famous 1927 rematch with Jack Dempsey. Now, Paul Beston in his book, I mean, he talks about Gene Tunney, but it didn't make him a major feature of it. But Tunney fights Dempsey a second time, and I'll give you the outcome, as you may know. Tunney wins, but there was something that was very controversial that happened during the fight. Do you remember that, Dave?
No, I do not.
It was the fight of the so-called long count. Jack Dempsey knocked Tunney down in the seventh round, but the referee did not start the count on Tunney, you know, for several seconds, as Dempsey did not immediately go to a neutral corner. And it gets a little involved. This was a new rule in boxing. Perhaps Dempsey never got the memo. I don't know. But he didn't go to the, you know, the neutral corner, and therefore Tunney had a few precious seconds to recover. And he did recover, and he got up and won the fight on a decision, I believe it was, when the fight ended. Now, years later, I mean, this was kind of, you know, how the fighters... Gene Tunney wasn't much for what you call trash talk, you know, like Mike Tyson, Muhammad Ali were known for.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a pleasant thing, you know, that Dempsey lost that fight. And I read some coverage that indicates that Jack Dempsey was sort of like a Mike Tyson fighter. You know, come out there and just pound you to death.
No.
That was that. But obviously he didn't do that in this fight. But anyway, years later, they kind of made up and, you know, helped each other out with different projects.
And a lot of these rules still apply, Bob. First of all, the memo thing still works well.
That's right.
The long count can still work for your favor.
Well, I hate to even bring this up, but neither of those fighters knelt when they were doing this.
I see. And the trash talk is bigger than ever.
Yes, the trash talk bigger than ever. Well, the interesting thing about Gene Tunney, he's sort of an atypical fighter in a way. Tunney trained in Speculator in 1928 for one more fight as world champion, defeating Tom Heaney of New Zealand. Tunney then resigned from the ring. Apparently, it was a promise he had made to his wife, Mary Polly Lauder, who was a wealthy socialite whom he had married that year. Other fighters, including Max Baer, his brother Buddy Baer, Max Schmeling, who fought Joe Louis a couple of times, won once, and in the famous bout, lost the second time. Max Schmeling trained in Speculator for his American fights. He was German. Maxie Rosenblum trained there. Jim Slattery, Knute Hansen, I don't know those last two names, actually, all trained in Speculator. This according to a pamphlet prepared by Lake Pleasant seventh graders in 1986 under the supervision of former town historian Ernest Virgil.
I used to work for a radio station, Bob, that I think all of the memos were put together by seventh graders.
It could be. The fighters who came in later years were more ostentatious than Tunney. Max Baer, for one, was said to love attention. Famous people came to see the boxers train. According to the student report, Bernard Gimbel of Gimbel's department store in New York suffered a few bruises when his airplane, leaving the golf course in Lake Pleasant, failed to climb high enough to miss the trees at the end of the fairway. After he retired from boxing, back to Gene Tunney wrote a book, A Man Must Fight, then went into business, and he was quite successful at it, of course. His wife's wealthy, too. He re-enlisted in the military, to his credit, in World War II, and was a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy, handling the Navy's physical fitness programs. He died in 1978. More recently, one of the champion's sons, Jay Tunney of Chicago, wrote a book about his father called The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, about the improbable friendship between his father, Gene Tunney, and playwright George Bernard Shaw, who was a boxing fan. Donations totaling over $200,000 were made to create Gene Tunney Park, just off Route 30 in Speculator. The park is at the site, formerly occupied by one of the hotels owned by the Osborne family, and it was the William Osborne, who got Gene Tunney to go up there. Jay Tunney and his wife, Kelly, joined well over 100 people for dedication ceremonies in 2014 for Gene Tunney Park. Jay Tunney told the Daily Gazette, quote, "My father was undistracted in Speculator. That was the best part. He could think of things and clear his mind and have things the way he wanted." And again, Gene Tunney, maybe not a typical boxer, he said, his son said that when his father was not training, he was frequently reading. His son said his favorite saint was Saint Francis, and the calm and beauty of the Adirondacks were helpful to him. Another son of Gene Tunney, John Tunney, served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 6 years and was a one-term United States Senator from California. So that's a little tribute or some coverage of Gene Tunney.
Interesting.
Yeah, from for the...
So what they were after was the solitude up there.
Well, that's what he was after. Yeah. You know, again, and I think maybe that's true for the fighters in general. There was one of the boxers that Paul Beston talked about that the manager's job was to keep him away from booze during the... And I forget which one it was. It was one of those early 20th century fighters. So.
All right.
So anyway, so that's one story. And I tell you what, it's a bit early, but I have another tale to tell, and we'll get to that in just a moment. After I say a word about our GoFundMe campaign for the Historians Podcast. We're really hoping to get some donations before the end of the year so that we can reach our goal. We're over halfway there, but things have, dare I say, slowed down quite a bit. We haven't had a donation in a while. And you can make a donation by online going to GoFundMe.com/historians2017. And you can then make a donation. It's easy to do. Some people are reluctant to give online, and we've got that handled also. You can just send us a check. Make out a check in any amount to me, Bob Cudmore, and send it to Bob Cudmore, 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, and the zip code is 12302. That's 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. This is the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore, joined by Dave Green. Dave, do you have a good memory?
No. Well, used to?
You, yeah.
I don't know. You know, it depends on what the subject is. What are you going to pick on here?
This next story ran recently in Focus on History in the Daily Gazette, and I suggested this title. I'm not sure they use this title. Fred Wojcicki's Remarkable Memory. This is an Amsterdam native that I know, Fred Wojcicki. And he has
one of these people who can remember what they did on any given day in their life.
Yeah, that is something, isn't it? Some people are like that. Now, that's not true of Fred, but he, to me, has a very good memory. Let me read just a few lines from the story. Fred Wojcicki, an Amsterdam native now living in Hacienda Heights, California, has been a source of information for this column for 10 years. He remembers a great deal about what he was doing when he was growing up and living as a young man in Amsterdam. And I write a lot about Amsterdam, and I found this very helpful. I've often said this about myself. I don't know if I ever said it to you. You know, I write about local history, and a lot of it has to do with the history of our lifetime, and I remember little of it. You know, I mean, I know where the basic outline, where I went to grammar school and junior high and high school, who my parents were and that sort of thing. But like I'll talk to people often for columns and they'll say, well, do you remember you used to do this? Like the other day I was interviewing somebody from my old neighborhood. Well, you remember we walked to school every day together.
But they're only remembering that particular slice.
Yes.
They're requiring you to remember everything.
Well, that could be. Yeah. But I don't remember that slice either, you know, the walking to school with that one gentleman. But Fred Wojcicki remembers a lot of things. He was born in 1926, and he lived in a rented flat on Hibbard Street in the Polish neighborhood of Reed Hill. If folks are out there figuring, yes, he's now gone into his 90s. The family moved from Hibbard Street to 20 Matthias Avenue when Fred was 1 year old. Neighbors there included John Gomulka, who became mayor eventually, and Andrew Selmer, who became chief of police. Harry and Victoria Vanderbeck operated a popular coffee shop. Jacob Bush became a police detective, and Gene DeLong was a football star at Amsterdam High, who Fred remembers eventually bought the Wojcicki family home. Wojcicki played baseball for St. Stanislaus Roman Catholic Church. When the team won, he remembered that the Reverend Francis Jewicki, their coach, treated the boys to Sundays at Krupsack's Pharmacy. So as you see, he has a very detail-oriented memory of his youth.
But that's a good thing, Bob.
Oh, it is a good thing.
Yeah, that's the... I remember. Yeah,
I know. It's that sort of thing. We do it as we get older. And Fred's memories, or when I print them in the column, sometimes engender other memories. Like there was somebody who wrote, it wasn't somebody, it was a man who also has a good memory, frequently contributes to my column, a retired physician down in the Washington, D.C. area, Dr. George Trauka was his name, or is his name, Dr. George Trauka. I believe, or I hope certainly he's still with us. But he said, reading Fred Wojcicki's account of St. Stan's School back in 1940, I remember this, and the other thing. So it got somebody else to open up. And Wojcicki also, he tends to write me letters, which is another, dare I say, lost art.
Certainly is.
Yeah. So I get a lot of quotes from Fred that he has sent to me in letters. Talking about growing up, he wrote, "Summer days were great days. Tennis in the early morning, then hardball in the church league. Coming home and doing chores, then off to the Roman Avenue or Brookside Avenue pool. In the evening, it was softball." That kind of makes me tired just to think of all those things.
Can you imagine these days, Bob, somebody saying to you, you know, when you finally get home, drop a letter to me.
Yeah. Well, Fred does that.
That's why I installed a computer.
I know. Well, and Fred has not. You know, some of my more senior contributors, they like to write letters, but they, like George Trauka, he will send me emails. But Fred just doesn't want any part of it. You know,
That's great. That's a great thing to do.
Yeah. Only one of Wojcicki's childhood chums had a bicycle, and Fred remembered that young man, who maybe should be nameless, let the other kids, quote, ride around the block for 5 cents a trip.
There was always someone in the neighborhood.
That's right. He was the Eddie Haskell, perhaps.
That's right, the entrepreneur.
Yep.
And there would always be some little old lady in the neighborhood saying, you know, you're going to be something someday.
Maybe he was.
Right, yeah.
I don't know. And Fred Wojcicki also wrote, in the winter months, talking about summer before, in the winter months, it was skating at Carp's Park, which I don't remember because it didn't exist when I was young. It was off Church Street. And skating in the winter in the fields by Amsterdam High, which is on Brandt Place, and those fields are still there. And it's not the high school anymore. It's the middle school, but that's kind of a digression. Or roller skating across from St. Mary's Church on East Main Street in the building which later became Kemp Buick. Remember those days, Dave, when there was a different car dealer on every corner, you know, different
Yes,
companies.
And we remember the days when we go back to make the visit and what used to be your tree fort is now Walmart.
That could be. Well, there was the Strand Theater, Fred wrote, the Rialto, the Orpheum, and the Regent, a big 10 cents for a double feature, cartoon, and short subject. After that, it was ice cream or hanging out at Shell's Pharmacy, Community Pharmacy, where they had ice cream parlors, Brownie's Hot Dog Shop, or at the pool halls of Amsterdam. And you mentioned the one on Reed Hill, Mises, I think it's pronounced, and Louis Allen's pool hall on Market Street.
In the days when you'd walk into the movie theater in the middle of the movie, but you would sit there and start the beginning all over again.
Yeah, you'd watch it from the beginning.
Yeah.
Amen. To top things off, Fred writes, there were always Amsterdam High football and basketball games or St. Mary's basketball. Then it was on to Doyle's Ice Cream Shop. We were too young to get into Bigler's Tavern.
But sooner or later learned.
Yes. Now, I know you enjoyed playing football when you were young. Did you go to the high school games? Was that a big deal? Or?
Once in a while. I was always just a big sandlot. I never played on the high school team. It was just, pickup games after school.
Right.
In the sandlot.
Well, I mean, I didn't play, of course, but I did, and some of my friends, we sold soda at the games.
Well, that's, being an entrepreneur about it.
That's right. We were out selling soda.
One of my prized possessions was the white football helmet my parents bought me one Christmas.
Really?
Yeah, and I didn't part with that for years, and then somewhere, I don't know.
Somewhere it went away.
Somewhere it went away.
Oh, dear.
Those are sad words, Yeah. Somewhere it went away.
Well, Bigler's Tavern that Fred mentioned, I do remember that. The building's still there, but Hasn't been a restaurant or tavern in some time, and it was also diagonally opposite the junior high, and it would be pretty hard for junior high kids to go over and get a drink, but their teachers did.
What?
At some of them at the lunchtime, you know. Oh, there goes Mr. So-and-so. Oh, look.
Did you have a paper route when you were kids?
No, I did not. I didn't do, you know, my first gainful employment was in radio. But did you have a paper route?
I had two of them.
Two of them.
Morning and night paper, back when there were morning and night papers.
Yes. Well, in fact, we've even had some paperboy stories in the column. John Naple, a good friend from Amsterdam who was very active in the library, he told a story about how he was delivering papers one day in Amsterdam, the East End, when Sam Stratton came to town during his first campaign for Congress. And he and Sam chatted a bit, and they kind of hit it off. And Sam paid him, I believe he paid him, to put his vote cards, you know, like a business card, mm-hmm. inside those days' paper, that day's papers.
Try that today.
Right. Yeah, no.
That's right. You'll have six lawyers. No, we can't do
what?
That.
You can't do that.
You can't do that.
Well, Fred also remembers going all the way back to his home up on Matthias Avenue that he used to feed Harry Dembski's horse with carrots. And Harry Dembski was the father of Kirk Douglas. Harry Dembski was the rag man. Kirk Douglas became the actor. And as I note in the column, like Wojcicki, Douglas pursued a career that took him to California. So, in fact, I believe Fred met Kirk Douglas once or twice, because when Fred moved to California, he married a woman. Well, it was originally, I think, from Lake Placid, but she was living out there. And her family worked in the movie industry. They weren't movie stars, but I think her brother was a driver or something like that, and her sister or cousin was a hairdresser. So they would invite Fred and his wife, Phyllis, to go to different movie things. And so once, I think they did see Kirk Douglas, and once he got a chance to chat with Henry Fonda about Henry Fonda being in the movie Drums Along the Mohawk.
I remember that.
Which was, you know, not shot here, but it was about the events in the revolution that happened in the Mohawk Valley.
You know, all these people moving around, you know, the entire population going somewhere, meeting someone, doing it. It's a little bit like data these days, you know. It only was human data.
Yeah.
And remains that way.
Exactly. Well, back to Fred's story, quoting another author, historian Robert Going, in his book Honor Roll about Amsterdam. He writes that Private First Class Joseph Wojcicki, Fred's older brother, arrived in France during the Normandy invasion in June 1944 and died July 18th after being wounded in battle at Saint-Lô, France. He was 31. He'd been a weaver at Mohawk Carpet Mills. And of course, Fred remembers his brother. He said his brother was really, and he said this with very little, I don't know, sarcasm, whatever. He said, you know, Fred's brother was really his mom's favorite. And he said he was my favorite, too. He was a very nice guy. And Fred, in addition to working as a weaver, had done, I guess you'd say, yard work for the elaborate Italian gardens in Broad Alban, created by summer resident Catherine Husted way back at the turn of the century, from the 19th to the 20th. But in the 1930s, the Italian gardens, and some of it's still visible there, what was the Italian gardens. But in the 30s, that estate was owned by Amsterdam button maker, a factory that made buttons, Arthur Chalmers. And Fred said he sometimes visited his brother at work and saw Arthur Chalmers go by in his chauffeured limousine. Fred also served in World War II. He served with the Navy Seabees in Guam, which has been back in the news,
mm-hmm.
and other locations in the Mariana Islands in World War II. We grew up fast in a few years during that war, he wrote to me once.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Fred Wojcicki came back to Amsterdam after the war. He and a man named Laverne Colts ran the Fort Johnson skating rink in the winters of 1949 and 1950. For a time, Fred was president of the Northeastern Skating Association. He worked, I'm not exactly positive when he was in Amsterdam, exactly what his jobs were, but he worked for, I believe, an insurance company and made friends with a prominent nun, a sister, who died recently, and Fred had things to say about her. The sister is, or was, Sister William Aloysius Fitzpatrick, who was the longtime head of the maternity department at St. Mary's Hospital. She died earlier this year. And when he worked for the insurance company, he had to get information from Sister William, or Sister William Aloysius, as we sometimes called her. And she was a little bit on the stern side, let's say. But apparently Fred and she forged a good friendship. And Fred's quote about her, and I would second this, she was always fair and honest, great to the patients and the parents alike. I remember Sister William more from the days after she no longer headed the maternity department, and she was one of the chaplains, and she frequently would visit the patients at St. Mary's Hospital, and really always was a bolt of sunshine or breath of fresh air or whatever you want to say when she would pay those visits. Fred Wojcicki moved to California in 1963. He married Phyllis Wood Gibbons in 1967, worked at Standard Brands Paint Company till retiring in 1989. Phyllis died in 2005. But when I hear from Fred, he's always talking about his garden, which he has, and he has help from a young man. He has relatives out there, but this young man does some of the work around the house. So it's been a pleasure knowing Fred Wojcicki.
Nice story.
And Dave, I have something to tell you right now. I note we have just a little bit of time left, and maybe we're kind of filling to some extent. But I don't think you know this. But this entire episode of the Historians Podcast up till now has been performed by me without my glasses.
And the reason was you needed to take off your glasses in order to read your
exactly
phone screen.
No, not my screen. I needed to take my glasses off to read directly from my book, and to read from my typescript of the Fred Wojcicki story.
Congratulations, Bob.
Thank you. Because, I usually keep the glasses on even when I'm reading stuff here, but I figured with a book, print in a book, I better go for it. The only thing is I'm having just a little trouble seeing the big numbers on the computer screen telling me how much time we've got.
Put on your glasses.
Well, I don't. They make noise when I... Yes, I could do that. I've seen you do that quite a bit. You take them on. Put them on, take them off. Put them on.
No, that's not actually true, but if I take them off, I'm lost.
Well, you got to have those glasses.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, anyway, thank you for joining us, Dave.
All right, Bob.
And this has been the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore.